I'm Dan Rodericks, and you're listening to Midday. Peter Moskus spent more than a year as a Baltimore police officer, assigned to the violent Eastern District of the city. He's also an assistant professor of law, police science, and criminal justice at the John Jay College at the City University of New York. Coming up in this hour of Midday, we'll hear about Peter Moskus's experience in the Eastern District and how those experiences shape his view of modern policing in big cities. How should police departments approach persistent drug trafficking? Does being on patrol make any sense anymore? Should police officers spend more time preventing crime than reacting to it, and how exactly would they do that? Cop in the Hood, coming up on Midday, after the news. And welcome, everybody, to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you again. Nice to be with you. Welcome to the second hour of our show today. Our guest is Peter Moskus, an assistant professor of law, police science, and criminal justice at the John Jay College at the City University of New York. Several years ago, as a research project, Peter Moskus sought to spend a year as an observer of a big city police force. That's what he wanted to do. And former Baltimore Police Commissioner Ronald Daniel, you might remember him, is one of several police commissioners we had in the last 7 to 10 years, took him up on the project on condition that he join the Long Blue Line here. So that's what Peter Moskus did, with 6 months of training as a cadet in Baltimore and 14 months as an officer in the crime-ridden Eastern District, annually the city's most violent. Peter Moskus writes about his experiences in a book from Princeton University Press entitled Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. Peter Moskus, nice to meet you.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Are you just visiting town doing interviews, or did you have another reason for coming back to Baltimore?
So the real reason is last night I was at my old sergeant's church as a crab feast.
Oh, really? Oh, that's important.
I come back every year for the steam crabs there.
I can understand why you would.
And I bring more and more people from New York once the word gets out, because we don't got them up there.
Among the police officers, brass and street cops that you got to know during your time here, any comments on the book? Have any of them read it?
Some have. Anyone who's read the book says good things about it so far. I have gotten some angry comments from some retired police officers who refuse to read the book, so it's hard to argue with people who won't read it. I think they...
That's great, isn't it? I get that with my column sometime in the paper. People are upset about what I wrote, even though you find out they didn't even read it.
But... I know. They take me for someone I'm not. I mean, what I hope... police officers aren't really the target of my book because they know it. They've done it, most of them, for longer than I have. But mm-hmm. I do hope that my book can help educate the public and other academics, too, about basically hardworking patrol officers and what they do and how they succeed and how they fail.
Let's explain to people how this came to be. We won't take too much time with this, but the premise and how you got into this. You were a grad student at Harvard, is that correct?
I was a grad student in sociology. I was first just going to look at the police academy, write some boring egghead dissertation on socialization or something like that. Anyway, Baltimore said I could, which Boston
could
said
what?
I could
observe?
Come and observe the class. But this was done under the man before Daniels. Frazier approved it.
Thomas Frazier. There's another name from the long list of commissioners.
I was here for less than 2 years and outlasted about three commissioners. So. Yeah, so I came here. Boston said no. New York wouldn't return my phone calls. Baltimore said yes. So I came here, and then Daniel took over. And I don't quite know because I wasn't in his office, but I believe he vetoed everything that Frazier ever approved in the politics of the department, and that included me. I don't think he knew I was here yet.
That included you as an embedded observer of the police?
Yeah. It was day two of the academy, and I don't think he knew I was here. I think he just scratched me off a list. About half an hour later, word filters down, and I show up in his office, so I don't have to go back to school with my tail between my legs. And then he says, well, why? I think he's surprised, but why don't you become a cop for real? And I said, who's going to hire me knowing I'm going to quit after a year, though I ended up staying two, but I'm going to quit and write a book. And he said, well, if you can get hired, I will. So I did.
Really? So that was the condition he made. We'll let you in as long as you sign up and go through the whole thing.
Yeah. And it worked out a lot better that
way.
The
other police departments that said no, just did not want to have a graduate student as an observer of their police department. That's it, just period, paragraph?
Well, New York under Giuliani was a pretty paranoid time, so they never got back to me. Mm. I met with the woman who led the Boston Academy, and she looked me point blank in the eye and said, I see what's in it for you, but what's in it for me?
Right.
And the truth is, it's hard to answer that. Right. I do know what's in it for me, is I'm going to finish school, write a book on it. It's my goal. I'd like to think that my book is going to help the police department become better, but it's tough to tell this woman I was staring at exactly how she's going to benefit, because right. maybe she didn't.
Whereas Ron Daniel, who was the police commissioner after Martin O'Malley was elected mayor, he was the first commissioner under O'Malley, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think yeah. so. So I wonder if I'm forgetting
It's hard to
one
remember
too.
Because Ed Norris came after he did.
Correct.
You told him that your plan was to work as a cop for a while and then probably quit. You weren't planning on making a career out of this.
Correct. And he was fine with that.
Were you certain about that?
That I wasn't going to stay?
Yeah.
Not 100%, but I was certainly... I mean, when I did quit, one of my friends who had 33 years on, he said, Pete, if I see you back here, I know you're a failure. And he didn't mean that against me or against Baltimore or the police department, but simply, look, if you have the opportunities to go get a degree from a good college, go and do it.
Right.
And I do enjoy teaching now. It pays better. Police need to get paid more. Well, as a teacher, I don't get paid great, but I get paid more.
Mm-hmm.
I get summers off so I can come here and see you, and no one shoots at me.
You're at the John Jay College now, then, teaching.
Yeah, John Jay is a public university in New York, so it's a lot of students there. It's a four-year liberal art college, but it's a little self-selective. So there's some active duty NYPD, New York police officers, and then a lot of cop wannabes who go there, because in New York you need 2 years of college to be hired as a police officer. So a lot of them go to a college like John Jay.
Did the city police department in Baltimore require you to sign any waiver that would supersede
Nothing.
Anything that would any coverage they would have liability in terms of liability?
Not at all. And that
beyond being a police officer,
Acting Commissioner Daniel, that was part of his fear was the legal legal issues involved. And by becoming a police officer, then I was. Just a police officer. Conveniently, Daniel was out of there before too long, and I think I just got lost in the administrative shuffle. And then I was always worried that someone was going to come knocking on my door saying, just what are you writing anyway?
Well, did the next commissioner know about you?
I don't know. I was on his show. It was not a very pleasant experience, in fact.
I heard that. That was recently.
Yeah.
But the period we're talking about here is 2000-2001.
I came here in late 1999, and I left... early summer 2001.
Okay. Did you have, just before we go on, before you actually launched your project, did you have any qualms about it, any misgivings, any second thoughts? How long did it take you to decide to actually do it?
I went in with a very blank slate. I don't come from a family of police. I didn't have friends who were police officers. I really didn't know what to expect, which to some extent made it easier. I didn't come here with an axe to grind, or I wasn't trying to prove anything that I knew. I mean, it was a learning experience from where I went. I said, I'm going to go and see where the fates take me, and see what comes up.
So you jumped in, and the first thing you did was go to the police academy. You went to the basement of the police headquarters,
I went to the basement of the headquarters, to the quartermaster's office, where probably, maybe it's changed, but I doubt it, where you're issued your trainee uniform unceremoniously into large, hefty bags. And I took him back on the number 10 bus down Eastern Avenue. And that was my introduction to the police department. It's the two very burnt-out officers working in the basement wondering, I wonder what they did to end up down here.
They just issued you your stuff.
Yes.
They weren't running the academy.
No.
So you found a place to live
mm-hmm.
out in Greektown,
mm-hmm.
right, where you'd be comfortable.
Thanks to the thanks to the good people at Icarus, they helped me find a place.
They suggested
to live.
A place in Greektown.
We Greeks stick together.
And the academy lasted 6 months, right?
Right.
What was that like?
The academy, and I know it's there's different people in charge now. So I what I'm saying about the academy does apply to my experiences in 1999 and 2000, but it was not a good experience. There were some police officers there who truly wanted to help and wanted to make you safe when you get the streets and teach you things.
Mm-hmm.
Certain parts were taught very well. The part in Sykesville, which was driving, the shooting, the gun range, had excellent instructors. I never touched a gun before becoming a police officer, and so I appreciated that training. And the law classes were taught very well, I thought, in the academy. But, you know, maybe that's the nerd in me. I thought that was interesting, actually, to learn that part. But you have and you're paying police, or future police officers, for 6 months, and it is such an opportunity to do more. And in large part, it was it's not a weed-out process. People were pushed through the academy. And we felt, meaning me and my classmates, felt that it just simply didn't train us for what we needed to know on the street, by and large.
You say in your book that they were basically teaching for the test.
Yeah, and it, yeah. You know...
And it's this long test you have to take to meet the state standards, right?
Right, and you felt very much that they were in a CYA mode for themselves. Mm-hmm. There were 50 people in my class, and one dropped back for health reasons. But all of us graduated. And I don't know for certain, I don't want to point fingers and say this person should have been hired, but if you have any group of 50 people, probably the bottom 5 or 10% should not be there. And that, it's once you get civil service protection, I quit the department basically after I got civil service protection. I thought, hey, once you can't fire me, then I'll quit.
Mm-hmm.
that amused me for some reason.
It does.
Turned in my papers on April Fool's Day. But it's hard to get rid of a police officer after they're on the street for a year.
Mm-hmm.
The academy is the time for that. And it's not easy. Look, you're going to get sued by people. It's, of course, unpleasant to fire someone and mess with their lives. But it's too important to let that bottom 5, 10% true in the
academy. And you didn't see any screening like that at all, any attempt to filter?
No.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of says, and they're all correct. Everyone says, well, it's not my job. My job is to train them and get them through.
Mm-hmm.
But someone's got to step up and take the heat and say, you know, preferably at an early stage before things happen, you know, you're just not cut out for this job.
This was 1999 to 2000. I need to go back to a question I wanted to ask you at the outset and forgot. Is why did you decide to publish this book now? It's out in 2008. Some of the material is dated from my reading of it, but, you know, a lot of it's very relevant. I'm not going to knock you for it. I'm just wondering, was your intention to write a book all along? Why not sooner?
Because first I had to finish school. That was intention number one.
Okay.
Was get my PhD, and it took me till 2004 to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, academia worked so slowly that it took me longer to write my dissertation on being a police officer than I was a police officer. I started writing the book then in the fall of 2004, and And that's how long it takes to write an academic book. I wish, ideally, it would have been out in 2002 or 3, but it would have been a different book. It would have been, I mean, as a, would have been more of a journalistic expose. Yeah, a lot of time has passed. It's been 7 years since I lived in Baltimore City.
And so you regarded it more as an academic book than as a journalistic expose.
It went more towards, now it's written, I mean, you read it, now it's written mm-hmm. more for the popular audience. But
it certainly is. The style, the prose style certainly is.
And I do want to make that clear to anyone thinking of buying it, that it's not a, there are no statistical regression, it's not a highfalutin academic book. It's meant to be a good read and a right. short read, and I think it is. But that's how long it takes, took me at least, to get the book out. So the part of it that I think lasts is, again, showing what the patrol officer does. Because I still do have friends in the police department, and the day-to-day life of the patrol officer hasn't changed. Things change at the top. I heard your previous guest. It's a tough act to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's doing good things. I applaud him and say more power to him. I would love for the violence in my book, I would love for that to be dated. I would love to come back and say, those were the bad old days,
mm-hmm.
You know, when we had almost 300 murders a year.
But there are some major issues dealing with the way the police department is run that remain. And some of them have to do with strategy. They have to do with the question of patrol and the whole war on drugs. We'll take a break and talk some more about this with Peter Moskos, who's our guest in this hour of Midday. Cop in the Hood is his book, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. You're invited to email a question at midday@wypr.org. Our phone number, if I can remember it since I was away on vacation, is 410-662-8780. Oh, how did I do? I remembered the number without having to look at the big wall. Okay, the sign on the wall. 410-662-8780 is a local number for Midday. Welcome back. 410-662-8780 is a phone number here for Midday. Dan Rodericks, our guest in this hour, is Peter Moskos, Cop in the Hood. His book is called My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District, and we remind folks that the year we're talking about is 2000-2001, right, Peter?
Correct.
Early in the book, after you've gone through the academy, and they assign you to the Eastern District. By the way, why did they assign you to the Eastern District?
They assigned, because that's where the crime was, they assigned half our class to the Western and half to the Eastern.
Okay, that's where you were needed.
Correct.
And these, the other folks that you met in the academy, and the ones you were soon to meet on the street, did you ascertain why they became cops? Especially those in the academy. Let's start with them. Did you get, just from conversations during breaks, having a cup of coffee, did you get some idea about why they wanted to be police officers?
Yeah, I'd say in general there were two reasons. There was sort of, and some of it split along racial lines. A lot of the blacks in the class, particularly African-American women, became police officers because they were single mothers and it was a good job. And they saw the benefits. They saw perhaps what it had done for some of their friends or family who were also police officers. And if you have a high school diploma or a GED in Baltimore, what's a better job if you have, you know, if you have kids than being a police officer? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of, the attitude was very much this is a good job and a wise career move. All police officers felt that a little bit or they wouldn't have applied. Among some of the younger white guys, there was more of a sort of an excitement idea that all my life I wanted to be a cop. I watched the TV show Cops. I got family who are cops. So there was a bit more of the excitement. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, immaturity about that, because there is a lot of boredom on the job. I mean, there's, you know, bits of excitement, too, which are usually pure terror.
Right.
But if you go into the job thinking it's all going to be fun and games and, you know, car chases and foot pursuits, very quickly you're going to get disillusioned. So it helps to have a bit more perspective.
Now, speaking of perspective, once you got into the Eastern District on the midnight to 8 shift, right, you met other officers and some of whom knew what you were up to, right?
No, they all did.
They all knew?
From day one, I was open about my research, yeah.
Okay, they all knew you were writing a book.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you learned from them, some of those who had been in the Eastern District for several years, and you wondered why they had been there for so long, because it's such a dreary place. It's, it's probably has the highest crime rate in the city and certainly the highest level of violence during that time in particular. Did you get from these guys why they were still there?
In general, officers want to get out of the Eastern and Western districts, and that's why I'm proud to, you know, put the title in my name. They're hardworking men and women, and they deserve a bit more respect, but the working conditions aren't great. The equipment's worse, the cars are worse. It's a tougher job to police there. There is more excitement, and it wears you and your equipment down. So in general, people want to get out of that district and go to a place that's a bit quieter and leafier. That being said, especially you might see it on the midnight shift, which is a permanent shift, if you just want to do your job and do it well and go home and not be bothered, there's no better place than midnights on the Eastern because departmental brass isn't going to be there. You're generally not bothered by administrative hassles. You're free to do your job and not get hassled. And the attitude is, look, where can they transfer me? I'm at midnights in the Eastern. If they want to move me, you know,
they're not going to demote me to someplace worse, right?
Exactly. Mm. Because arguably there is none. I enjoyed working midnight shift. Also because I had a good squad, I had a good sergeant. For me, I was quite happy with that.
Did some of those in your squad not want to have anything to do with you? Because they knew you were writing a book?
I'd say one guy did, but the truth is I didn't want to have anything to do with him either. So
okay.
that was mutual.
Okay.
In general, there was, and of course now, years later, and you know, still being friends with a lot of the people, I can just ask them. And yeah, there was a lot of apprehension at first. They just didn't know who I was. And later on, I asked my sergeant, look, there's nothing that bad going on here, so why were you so afraid? And he says, well, you know, it depends on how you define bad. And look, cops, well-intentioned cops break departmental regulations all the time. You have to be a good police officer. If you want to really want to get a police officer in trouble, you know, they can always find a way. If they want to get you, they can.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the intentions come in. I didn't go in there to write a kiss and tell, and I didn't write in kiss and tell, but it's not like, but there wasn't anything great to kiss and tell about.
Well, it was also a time of some paranoia among police officers. When Martin O'Malley ran for mayor, he ran with two elements to his platform. One is reducing crime, and the other one was restoring confidence in the police department by rooting out corruption and bringing in reform. Wasn't there a period of some paranoia among the officers during that time?
I think there's been a period of paranoia in police departments since about 1845 when
But even more so, then you have a mayor a new mayor saying that this is what he was going to do.
Yeah, but don't forget that honest cops and the vast majority are good and honest. They don't want bad police officers there any more than the members of the public do. So if the department can, every time a if a corrupt police officer gets caught, officers applaud that. They don't want him there. Mm-hmm. They want to go about and do their job, and they don't want that person, you know, besmirching their reputation. And I think because of TV and movies, people think the police department is more corrupt and more brutal than it is. I saw, and myself included, I mean, there's some rude policing going on out there, but it is not in Baltimore City a culture of corruption and a culture of brutality. Yes, we know they're corrupt officers because occasionally they get caught and fired, but it's not, cops don't want to risk their pension. Mm-hmm. Some of it's just professional pride. It's the wrong thing to do. But look, you retire after 20 years, they're going to pay you for as long as you can live. You don't want to risk that by shaking down some two-bit drug dealer for $100. It's just not worth it.
You're listening to Midday. This is Dan Rodericks. Our guest is Peter Moskos. His book, Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. Our phone number is 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join the conversation. Early in the book, you describe and quote, and then they're not named, there's very few names actually in the book of police officers, and you talk about the crude shorthand that cops use to describe their situation and different things that happen during the working day. Were you surprised at the level of harshness of some of these statements that they made about the ghetto? Because you use the term ghetto frequently in the book, so I'm going to use it.
Yeah, I use the term because the people I policed, by and large, used it. Not everybody in the Eastern District, and it's considered offensive for many people, but the people I policed, the criminals, did use the term ghetto when all cops do. So mm-hmm. I figured it'd be a bad nod to political correctness to pretend we don't use that term.
You had some cops saying that they think the ghetto should be torched, that it should be flooded and everyone in it drowned. It gets that harsh.
It does get that harsh. Remember, some of it does that. A lot of cops believe that. And if you're around there day after day, you start to sort of get more sympathetic to that point, though I personally don't subscribe to that. Mm-hmm. The other thing you have to remember is if you're sitting, well, you're usually patrolling alone, but if you're in the same car next to somebody all night for 8 hours, day after day, cops are good talkers. They're good BSers. We can tell a good story. Mm-hmm. And so, to some extent, the quotes, I mean, I'm writing down the interesting stuff. It is a book. I'm not putting in the boring parts. Though I do write about the boring parts, and it's a tough job to write. How do you write about boring things?
Well, that's why
I ask
about, interestingly. But that's why I ask about these quotes in particular.
Yeah, but there is, police don't like, they don't like the area. They don't understand why it's the way it is. They don't understand why it stays the way it is, and they're unsympathetic to it. They don't
but you present a theory on why they think of it as they do. They think that there's a ghetto culture that breeds the crime, that it's not the other things that as sociologists tend to look at, which is poverty, and dysfunctional families, child abuse, drug addiction.
And most sociologists who study that don't go into the actual district and talk to people. Mm-hmm. Police officers are there, and for that, you know, I respect their opinion. And when I ask police officers, and it was funny because it was in 2000, you know, why is this area so messed up? And they go, Hillary Clinton. She is reviled personally by...
Where does that come from?
She represents, excuse me, she represents a lot of things that a lot of police officers don't like.
Which is what? Well, females in politics?
No, liberalism. What we've seen is failed liberal policy.
She supports the death penalty, Hillary Clinton. Do they know that?
They probably don't believe she really does deep down because it's all a conspiracy.
Yeah. Did you get into conversations with these guys about this?
Of course. I was in a conversation just earlier this morning before coming here with my sergeant watching Fox News. Mm-hmm. I talk about it all the time. And one of the reasons I love police as much as I do is coming to here and saying, look, I'm a Harvard grad student writing a dissertation. I'm not a pretentious person by nature, but those were the facts. And I'm a liberal, and I'm open about that. I found more tolerance towards my positions among police officers who disagree tremendously with them mm-hmm. than you would find at your average liberal college about the position police officers hold. I mean, there to some extent so much for liberal tolerance. I have wonderful debates all the time when I come here about politics. But going back to the ghetto and the problems, to me, there is something wrong. It's not all just money. It's not, oh, if there are just jobs for everyone. Look, there are a lot of people right now in Baltimore that no one would want to hire because mm-hmm. They lack mainstream social skills, because they're violent, because they can't do math, functionally illiterate. This is not just, I mean, that's a problem with education, but beyond that, there's something about the culture of violence. There's something about thug culture, something that stems from from the drug trade and war on drugs. Mm-hmm. The issues, and as a police officer, look, if we could make the world a better place, I'm all for that. But I mean, as the commissioner was saying earlier, look, as a police officer, we're focused on what we can do as police. And that's something different. But look, my answer about why we are problems in American cities, and it's not just Baltimore that's got problems, why they're so bad is I find that liberals refuse to accept the fact there is something culturally wrong that's got to change, and conservatives either don't want to spend any money or simply have given up on it. Both sides are wrong. We have to come together. We got to say, yes, there's something wrong right now in a lot of our cities among a subgroup of high school dropouts, generally African-American men involved in the drug trade with access to guns. Mm-hmm. This is where the violence is coming from.
Did you ever come away from a conversation with one of those police officers thinking that he or she was a racist?
I think they're incredibly unpolitically correct. I think there's some racist cops, like they're racist everywhere. But by and large, no. By and large, they're professionals doing their job. But yeah, they're saying things that you probably wouldn't want to say in a cocktail party in an Ivy League college.
Or anywhere. Why do you put it in those terms?
Because I think
really?
The politically correct police are a bit
stronger.
All right,
stronger. You might say it at a crab feast with cops. Maybe you can get away with it. But
hey, it's a church. We're watching our...
I mean, but why do you have to frame it that way, that the only place such language isn't allowed?
I'm not talking about racist language. I'm talking about unpolitically correct language. I'm talking
like
about...
Like flood the ghetto? Like, I mean, that's basically calling for a draconian wiping away of thousands of people who live in the ghetto.
And for the record, that was a black officer who was saying that, too.
Okay. What was the other one that talked about torching?
Napalm.
Was he white?
Yeah, okay. He was white. But the point is that this wasn't a race issue. This was a cop issue. And it's seen on class. It was not seen as a race issue. It's lower class blacks in the Eastern District or lower class whites in Pigtown or Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Perhaps at some level, I think, this is America. I think a lot comes down to race. But from the police officer perspective, it's a class issue and it's a culture issue. And they speak honestly. And I applaud them for that. I don't want to knock them for that.
Let's get to the cycle that probably creates a lot of this cynicism. And that is the drug use, the sale of drugs, the corners. It goes on and on. And you say at one point in the book that basically your job had become just to clear corners, constantly clearing corners. That's all you were doing for a period of time.
Yeah, to say it's a truce is the wrong word because it's not. It's more a war is a correct word. But there's some point where you do the same thing day after day, and this is where the job gets tiring. This is where you start to get burnt out. You take over the car, you pick up some coffee, and then you start clearing corners, and you clear the same people off the same corners every night, night after night. And they don't generally want to deal with you any more than you're all looking for action on every call. So I call it the dance in the book, which is you pull up, and if they're being courteous, they walk around, they leave. They walk around the block, but then they come back. The problem is, as a patrol officer, there's not much you can legally do. In general, they're not dealing drugs in front of a marked patrol officer. So, I mean, you know who is, because you can watch through binoculars or... And you get the calls. You know what's going on. They're there every night. This is mm-hmm. not a secret. But look, I'm patrolling. Let's say I pull up on a drug corner because someone called 911 or 311. There's probably one kid, and he probably is a kid, anywhere from 13 to 18 years old, who's the actual slinger, who's got the vials of crack or the pills of heroin on him. I can lock him up. He's committing a crime. But what's that going to do? He's not the kingpin.
Right.
If it's a smart drug dealer, he's not going to be touching drugs or money. Mm-hmm. You can lock him up for loitering, if he doesn't leave and he's sitting on a private stoop or something. But that's going to be a couple hours in jail, a night in jail at most.
Or 30 days, maybe.
Not for loitering.
Not for loitering. Well, that's right, because we had the, early disposition court that came into play here.
Yeah, but
there's others who may be off the street for 30 days.
Yeah, but someone else is going to be back there slinging the next day, because the problem is not that 14-year-old kid who's got bad parents, who is hanging out in this corner because that's the best thing he's got. Someone else does to help that guy, but in terms of if I lived on that neighborhood, that kid disappears, someone else will take his place, and that's because people want to get high. People are going to be buying drugs somehow. That's what addiction's about. If you're a heroin addict, you wake up, you're going to get your drugs. That's mm-hmm. a given. That's the only thing you know about that day.
But aren't cops under the pressure, at least at the time, to meet quotas for arrests? We heard a lot about that in the press and a lot of debate about it and a lot of denials that such a thing existed in the O'Malley administration when Norris was commissioner.
In general, I'm going to say no. There was not an official quota. That being said, is in my book at one point, yeah, if you made no arrests during a 4-week period, you got in a little bit of trouble. It's hard to make no arrests if you're a cop in the Eastern District. I mean, there's no excuse to make zero. If you want to call that a quota of one, yes, it's a quota. But no, it wasn't that you have to make 10 lockups and write 20 parking tickets. But police are judged by arrests and by stats. And in the police world, arrests are good. And the more arrests, the better. And that's they're good arrests. And they're not as good arrests, but there's no such thing as a bad arrest. Arrests are good.
So during that time, Peter, did the other officers, the veterans, the ones that have been around for a while, tell you, yeah, they're under more pressure to get more arrests, get more humps, as you call them, off the street, off the corners?
Well, we didn't really call them humps, but
I remember that
hump was a lazy police
officer.
I'm sorry.
Well, hump is another term I've heard defense attorneys use.
Yeah, hump.
I'm sorry.
It's all different.
Go ahead. The hump that I meant was not the hump that you meant.
The
guys off the corner, guys who are yelling, selling, slinging, as you say.
More pressure? No, there's always some pressure. But if you do,
but there were more arrests during that period of time.
There weren't more arrests when I was there than before O'Malley was mayor. And also, just, I mean, to point out, the number of arrests is truly shocking. At the time, the Eastern District had 45,000 people living in it,
right,
according to the census 2000. We made 20,000 arrests every year. It's not that every other person's getting locked up. There are lots of repeat customers.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a scale of lockups that is just, I mean, I found it shocking. And it would be one thing if it were working, but it wasn't.
Well, that's what I want to get at. You know, it did escalate after you were gone and you were still working on your dissertation.
The book, yeah.
By the year 2005, when Leonard Hamm was commissioner, I quote here from my own newspaper, The Sun, the number of arrests in Baltimore City for that year jumped to 105,000 from the 71,000 arrested in 2000 when you were around.
But before that, it was like 80 or 90,000.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, it's a high figure. I mean, there's a big difference.
Well,
but
it gets to the strategy. The strategy was the more bad guys or bad women are off the streets, the less crime there will be. That was the idea.
Yeah, but we either got to lock them up forever, which we don't do, or we got to try something else.
Peter Moskus is our guest. His book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. Princeton is the publisher. 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. If you'd like to ask Peter Moskus a question, his book is called Cop in the Hood. I wanted to ask you about this incident. This is just one of many anecdotes that I find really fascinating in your book. This was an incident in April of 2000 when you went to a place, a house at Harford and North Avenue, a report of a larceny. You remember this?
Mm-hmm.
This is an older man who said that his gun was missing, or that someone had stolen a gun from his home, correct?
Correct.
And he actually accused a particular person whose name he gave you and address he gave you.
Correct.
And the young police officer, Peter Moskus, wrote a report.
Mm-hmm. I was in field training at the time, so I was with a more experienced officer.
Right.
And the older man was with his son, who, if I remember correctly, was probably about 40 or 50 years old, the son was. And the son told us that, his memory was a little good. Anyway, I wrote a report relating exactly.
He told you the old man's memory wasn't so good. Right?
Yeah, and the old man admitted that himself.
Okay.
I wrote a report saying exactly what he said, which is he thought someone may have stolen his gun. He saw it a month ago, and he believes that Squeaky had taken it, and all names have been changed. And he gave us an apartment.
So Squeaky, yeah, that you had an address for Squeaky.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Gave my field training officer that report, and he said, no, this isn't it. He said, this is not a larceny. This is lost property. And I wrote a second report, which is factually not wrong.
But it omits the whole Squeaky thing.
But it omits the whole suspect.
It omits the suspect. Now, I was reading this. Of course, I'm looking back now several years to this period. Now there's an effort on, to really go after guns. And because there are so many in the city, and it's a big
effort.
It's a good effort, and it's joint federal state.
Because you need the federal stick of prison.
Yeah. Today, I mean, it probably would serve us to have a police officer be able to write a report suggesting that the person suspected of having this weapon is so and so. Because is that still not allowed? Is that why?
Oh, it's allowed, and we could have. The problem is, I mean, given this case, he had no proof. He didn't. I mean, to say. He wasn't even certain it was stolen. It's, look, as I write in the book, probably if I'd done it later alone, I would have at least knocked on the door just to see what came up. But it wouldn't give me the legal right to go in that house. It wouldn't give me the right to search anything.
She wouldn't have to tell you anything.
And she'd be dumb if she did.
Right.
But you need some more proof than someone saying, my gun is gone, I think she did it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the basis of a good case. But the point of this wasn't to lower stats or lower the crime rate. The purpose was simply bureaucratic. It's less paperwork. I don't want to hassle a detective with this because they're going to have to follow up if it's a part one crime, and nothing can happen in this case.
Reflecting on that, what do you think?
I think it's probably correct. Though I still
what,
at a time
don't would, hassle with it because there's no grounds to search a person's
I would
apartment.
Have gone and knocked on the door. I think that what a good police officer would do. It can't hurt. Knock on the door, see what comes up.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of, are you going to follow up and investigate? I mean, it's, are you going to follow up an investigation for larceny based on the fact that a admittedly senile man can't find his gun?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, now there is a gun. It would be nice to find that gun because
you
don't want something to happen with that. But it wasn't part, and it was
part of
relate,
your education, though, wasn't it?
It does relate. And look, there were strategies from the top of the time, and there's strategies today. And today, this year, murders are going down. Hey, if that's true, that's great. Part of the problem in the that I write about in the book is simply to get these strategies to the level of patrol officer is tough. You've got half the department in patrol, basically. It's a great resource, and it's underutilized. These are men and women who want to do a better job, and by and large, they just spend their shift answering radio calls. And to a large extent, that's a waste. It's a waste of good police officers.
So what do you suggest? Put them on the street? The public would like to see more officers on foot.
I think more patrols should be on foot. To some extent, look, anyone who needs police, if you call 911, the old public enemy line, 911 is a joke. If you need them, it's hard to get a police officer. You need rapid response for fire trucks and for ambulances,
mm-hmm.
Not for police. That's responding after the crime has been committed. I want cops out there on foot. I want them out there interacting with people. And if it takes them a few minutes longer to answer a call, fine. You need some police in cars for backup and so on, but by and large, I think patrol should not be done in a police car in a dense city like Baltimore.
You think driving around in a police car or sitting somewhere in a police car is a waste of is poor strategy?
Yeah, and you know what? It's better to be sitting.
It's
in
Duncan, costly too, isn't it?
It is costly, gas, car, and so on. It's better to be sitting in Dunkin' Donuts drinking coffee because at least you're more approachable. At least you're going to hear things. At least you're talking to people in the public.
In the Eastern District, on an average shift, how many calls would you get?
It would range a lot from a cold, rainy night where you might, for primary calls, you may just get a couple, two or three. And then there are also backup calls. I'm trying to think what my busiest was, but, then you start getting in the 20-30 range. And the midnight shift is slower because, the city generally after 3 or 4 a.m. does go to sleep for a few hours.
And you were in a car by yourself?
Usually, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What was your first arrest? Do you remember that?
Of course, everyone remembers their first arrest. It was a man at the supermarket on Harford Road, which I don't think is there anymore. The Super Pride, I believe it was, and it was shoplifting, and went into the back room where the shoplifter was, and the man held out his hands, and I put the plastic flex cuffs on.
Had a security guard detained him?
Yes.
What had he stolen?
He had stolen packs of meat.
Hmm. Do you know what he intended to do with the meat, did he say?
I don't remember. Probably save one for himself and sell the rest in a bar.
Mm-hmm. How many did he have, do you remember?
Yeah. I want to say 7 or 8, but I think it was the same day or the next day we got a whole semi-trailer, refrigerated, stolen trailer of meat, and there were boxes removed from that, and that day we could smell the grills and the barbecue throughout the neighborhood. That was a real theft.
Did that man have a previous record?
Generally, you don't know for adults, the juveniles that you know. Adults, you call for the wagon, they come and pick them up. And that's
the end of it.
Yeah.
But
so
if you arrest a juvenile.
If you arrest a juvenile, it's a lot more, and I hope this has changed since I was a police officer, though I don't have faith that it has. There was a lot of paperwork, and to take them to booking, which, now that's a shame, but that time was done in the old Northern District. And you got to run I never arrested anybody for the first time, at least no kid, probably no adult either. And that to me was amazing because everyone.
They all had previous.
At some point, someone's got to make the first arrest. It never was me. And I arrested, 13, 14-year-old kids.
Hmm.
And it's those kids that you go, maybe one or two of them might make it. But then you often take them back home and you see the homes they come from. And it's like, it's not fair to blame teachers because they only got them for 8 hours a day.
If they get them
for that.
Was there a particular kid you remember from your year on patrol?
in terms of someone who I would know is the short answer. I mean, I remember a lot of the kids, but in someone who I could follow up and hope he made is someone who
Yeah, or a particular circumstance maybe that you recall.
There's some child abuse cases. I mean, well, this is a actual murder where if a guy shook his baby. You know, I remember that house, and the baby, of course, this is not around anymore, but I do sort of wonder. I wonder, you know, the father was 14 or 15, you know.
Right.
I do sort of wonder now he's 24 or 25.
Peter, do you remember ever arresting a child, a juvenile, who cried? They don't do that in front of police officers?
Well, so it's on the minute. They were very tired. Yeah, they're tears. Once you get in, you know, they're tough till they get in the back of your car, and then they tend to break down. But mostly it was sort of exhaustion you'd see at 3 a.m. If you're a 14-year-old who just committed an armed robbery and you got caught, they were just shut down, basically.
I want to go back to the drug issue, because didn't it seem at some point that everything you were involved in, every call in some way related to drugs? I mean, even the man shoplifting with meat.
He was a drug addict.
Right. We assume those things.
Right.
And the actually police department statistics indicate it's a very high percentage of crimes related to the drug trade, heroin and cocaine in particular. Both.
Yeah, and heroin itself is a nasty drug. If you're willing to define drug crime broadly, the vast majority of everything we deal with is drug crime, from fights, even domestics, and certainly the violence, the shootings and the cuttings. And that's why, you know, generally not a popular belief among police officers, but I think we got to regulate drugs, and regulate means legalize. To me, the war on drugs is just a failure, and it's not that people aren't trying, and it's not, you know, they're out right now working to clear drug corners, but in the grand scheme, it doesn't work. And it's not so much that, the heroin addiction's bad, and I don't got the answer to addiction, but I do have the answer to kids shooting, to drug dealers shooting each other on the corners. The public drug dealing, that's the problem. If we can get drug dealers off the corner. Look, a lot of people buy and use marijuana, and they don't shoot each other because they're buying from their colleagues and friends and coworkers like they're supposed to. If you can do that, and I never know about it, I got no problem with that.
Right.
But we have to, just like we regulate tobacco and regulate alcohol, we got to regulate the more dangerous drugs. What we have now is a free-for-all. It's too dangerous for that.
You say in your book, it's beautifully put, I think, standing in the hole of failed prohibition, can't we stop at least digging this hole?
We've been at this for 80 years, and we tried with alcohol prohibition, which also failed. The problem when you prohibit a substance is you lose the ability to regulate. You can't count it. No one has to get shot over what is commerce.
Mm-hmm.
They're shot not because it's drugs, they're shot because it's prohibition. There would still be drug problems, but there would be so much less. Then you could worry about saving lives. Let's not forget the number of people who overdose in Baltimore every year, and it's gone down a lot, but it's still a horribly high number.
Mm-hmm.
All that's preventable. Addicts don't want to overdose. They overdose
by
accident.
If it just went inside, if it came off the corners and went into houses, would the police sort of abide that? Would most cops wouldn't have an opportunity?
Currently, no. What I'm saying, look, and if neighbors complain, I don't think that's good either.
Right.
Again, the problem is a lot of drug dealers, I wish they were professionals, but they're not. They're loud, obnoxious kids, so they'd be loud, obnoxious indoors.
They don't think this way in terms of marketing, do they?
Yeah. To some extent they do, but ultimately they're just not good enough. They're not at that. But, you know, hey, if when it's snowing in the middle of February at 4 a.m. and a guy's standing on the corner, you go, that's a good work ethic.
But it's incredibly disorganized, isn't it? I mean,
the way it's changed,
I think, since the 70s is that in the 70s, I remember a time in New York City, Boston, and Baltimore, Philadelphia, when the names of prominent drug dealers would appear in newspapers regularly.
And now those are the good old days. Yeah.
Right. When they were known.
Crack changed that.
The crack changed that. And that was in the 80s, and it broke it all up into smaller groups.
It brought drug dealing to the masses. Right? Anyone with 10 bucks could become a drug dealer. And drug dealers got younger. They got more impulsive, more violent. And it was a bad time in American cities.
Right. And by the time you hit the street in 2000, 2001, it was still pretty much that way, wasn't it?
By and large, yeah.
I mean the so-called drug kingpin, I mean, it's getting more organized, you think? Again, more concentrated?
No, I just mean the crack epidemic, it wasn't at its peak anymore. It had died down a little bit. But no, I don't think it was more organized. We talk about this drug kingpin. There's always someone. You can go, you can arrest people up the chain, but none of that's going to solve the problem. It's not like there's one guy at the top, when we get rid of him, suddenly all drugs will disappear.
Right.
Kingpins can be replaced too. Mm-hmm. That market system, there's a supply and demand issue, and as long as people want to get high, people, and there's money to be made, criminals are going to do it. I just want to take it out of the hands of criminals.
Do most of the officers that you met, did most of them express the wish that this would just go away, that they didn't have to bother with it? I mean, do they basically agree with you on decriminalization?
Generally, no. There is some agreement from a libertarian perspective, which is this shouldn't be the government's business. People should be free to do what they want. But that's a minority perspective.
Among the officers you knew.
Yeah. There's a big propaganda machine out there. And it's not, police say, look, drugs do cause problems, which I admit. I'm not saying drugs are good. In a way, they lack the vision. There's not an open, well, there is because I'm on the show talking about it, but there's not an open public debate about drug legalization yet. It's not a presidential issue. No politician can come out for it. Mm-hmm. No police chief can come out for it. It's still a taboo
subject.
Including mm-hmm. myself. Mm-hmm. but it's still a taboo subject, and that's one thing I hope my book changes. Look, I don't got all the answers, but let's at least talk about some of these things, because there are other places that do it better. Why not learn from them?
Name one.
Amsterdam, the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. You can walk into a legal, regulated store and buy marijuana or hash. It's been that way for decades, and fewer people have tried marijuana there than in America. That's the importance. It's not a nation of stoners, and certainly no one. And look, from a police perspective,
I don't ever see this changing. I know you want to have a debate. I'm all for having the debate.
But is it going to change?
But I don't see how it can change, given politics in America. I can't imagine there ever being the public will on the part of any elected official to talk about this openly.
Well,
I mean,
once
Mayor Schmoke did it. Kurt Schmoke famously did it, right?
Yeah, look what it got him, right?
Yeah.
As marijuana, so it could be decriminalized in California. If it works, if people don't kill each other, things like that can spread. I think it would be a gradual process. But don't forget, too, we had a constitutional amendment banning alcohol, prohibition. Can you imagine in 1928 thinking, what are the odds that we're going to pass an amendment overturning this? Mm-hmm. It did happen. I don't think it's likely either.
But
if I were a betting man, I wouldn't bet on it.
The difference, Peter, was it was legal at one time.
People could remember the legal days.
Yes, and then it came back and was made. By the way, it was the highest spike in homicides in America. If you look at the charts,
it peaked in the prohibition.
And again during the crack epidemic in the 80s. It was two prohibitions.
Of course, the other difference now in the war on drugs, we've been at it for almost a century, but now we're locking up so many more people. For a rich country, it's a shame to have 2 million people, more than China. We can lock up more than China, and they got a billion. They're a billion Chinese, and they lock up fewer people than we do. And whether you think they deserve to be locked up or not, I don't want to pay for it. It's expensive. Yeah. There's got to be a better way, and I
that cultural change that we were talking about earlier. We don't. That's something we also don't talk about either. It's sort of taboo to speak about this in terms of culture. But how do you begin to change that? I mean, I can see that that's part of this, but how do you change it?
By regulating drugs, putting it in the hands of businessmen. Yeah, because it comes from quick money. It's not a lot of drug dealers, by the way, aren't getting very rich, but it's better than no money. If you're in a poor neighborhood, mm-hmm. you leave the day with even $50. That's $50 more than someone else has.
Yeah.
And then you combine that with, you got to be violent. The reason drug dealers are violent, yes, it becomes part of the culture, and there is an impulsiveness, and you're too quick to reach for a gun. But the real reason is simply because, from a business standpoint, because you can't go to court. If you have a dispute, you can't call a police officer and say, this guy I gave him drugs and he didn't pay me. It's not something you can settle civilly. So you abuse violence and threats.
When you signed off, when you finished your last shift, what was that like for you?
I had a little retirement party. I hope there were crabs at it. I actually don't think there were crabs at that party. Got in my van and drove north.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the officers that you'd worked with during that time say they didn't want to be included in the book, didn't mind being quoted? Looking back after a year's time, thinking of the things they might have said in your presence.
No, I haven't none of that. And technically, actually, it wasn't a retirement party. I didn't retire. I quit. I wasn't here long enough. But I had a going-away party. Mm-hmm. There was one lieutenant who has since emailed me, and he said early on he wanted nothing to do with my book. And I think the quote's in the book. But other than that, he's not in there. Mm-hmm. But he didn't do anything bad. Again, the idea is what good's going to come out of it. And I think when the book, I showed it before it got published to guys I worked with. Cops are not criminals. They're not out there doing bad things. But the names are changed. I don't want them to even get in trouble for minor violating regulations. Things that we all do as police officers.
So you disguise people pretty well in here.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people though. By style of speech, if you know these guys, some of them are pretty easy to figure out because of the way they talk.
I just don't know what's going to happen with this recommendation that we decriminalize. I mean, we keep coming back to this. Had a great conversation with the defense attorney, Billy Murphy, about this. And I just don't see it happening. But that's your recommendation.
Yeah.
Read the book and you'll find out why. We'll get the whole background on it. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the book and thank you for your time here with us today. Peter Moskus's book is Cop in the Hood, My Year Policing Baltimore's Eastern District. It's published by Princeton University Press. That's Midday for today. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you again tomorrow.